Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 783.JB2813, certificate number 38661, the MGM auction.
Tap your heels together three times and think to yourself, there's no place like home.
So we've already talked on the show about my recent visit to the Jeopardy soundstage to...
Where you barely avoided arrest.
That's right.
They still got your picture at the gate.
That's right.
Do not admit this man.
They didn't, nobody got a chance to chase me because I was literally standing next to them already. They were like, wait a minute, we're already looking for you. And I'm like, here I am.
Our security guy also just had a hip replacement or maybe a knee. So I'm not sure. Probably could outrun him.
I was taking advantage of that whole situation. Also the fact that the editing guys left the door propped open.
Yeah, they're probably the ones who got in trouble more than you.
But when I first arrived on the lot and shook off my handlers, I wandered around quite a bit, kind of enjoying the being on the Sony lot. And everybody that's there assumes that you belong there because that's the only people that are there. And so I got a lot of friendly nods, curious nods, some curious nods. But I think that's mostly because I look like a movie star. People were like, there he is. I mean, I'm not sure who he is.
I think it's because you're a large, tall man, but you don't have good enough cheekbones to be an executive.
So
they're like, this guy can't be a comedy. He's like in too good shape to be a comedy writer, but not in good enough shape to be a performer.
Yeah, his skin does not show signs of using product, right? There's no moisturizer on this guy.
And by the way, the lot does not feel like... Like, you know how in movies you walk down a movie lot and it's like you're passing Roman soldiers and cowboys and all that? You don't get much of that.
That's what I was hoping for. And as you know, the Ghostbusters cars are kind of parked there. And then later on, when you and I walked around between tapings, you showed me there are a few streets that kind of look like they were made as sets but now are used as office space, right?
Yes. The Jeopardy offices are actually located on a street that's meant to look like kind of a waterfront, like a kind of a divey kind of port. Maybe like Batman is going to interrupt a smuggling shipment there or something.
But pretty clean. Like they would have to
dirty it up. Yeah. And remove all the... you know, fire extinguishers and whatnot.
But there were a few what seemed like kind of little stacks of props, big props like trucks or whatnot that were behind a little fence maybe.
There's still a lot of active shooting on the lot. When Matt Damon and I were on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, name drop, he had actually...
Your friend Matt Damon.
Well, my best friend Matt Damon and I were on Millionaire. He was surprised to wind up on the lot because he had been shooting Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey movie there the day before.
Hmm.
He assumed the car was taking him to Burbank or something, and he looks around and he's like, oh, wait, that's our soundstage. So there's actually movie production going on there, which is not super common in LA right now.
Do you ever peek in and see, did he ask you to go into the Odyssey thing and see the sets?
Nothing going on a weekend.
Presumably the sets are still there.
I am tempted. Like, I know, that, you know, when a show I like is shooting on our lot, like I think For All Mankind shoots on our lot. I don't know what else. I think The Boys is in Canada. What else shoots on our lot that I watch? Anyway, every time I see I think, I should just go over and see if anybody at stage seven is a Jeopardy fan and they'll let me wander around.
Don't you? I mean, your little badge that you use to identify yourself, isn't it some kind of gold card? Doesn't it get you in anywhere you want?
That's a great question. It has definitely gotten me into our stage and the Wheel of Fortune stage.
Okay, sure.
But could it get me onto the set of For All Mankind? My guess is no, if their really? System works right.
Well,
they don't want just anybody wandering into a TV show shoot just because they can get into the editing suite.
Let me tell you, it's pretty easy to get into
Jeopardy.
Any places on Jeopardy. When we went into the Jeopardy offices, you and I walking through, the lights were all off, and you were like, here's this library, here's that library, and here's a
pretty glamorous.
Yeah, here's an office that has my name on the door. I've never even walked in the door.
That is correct.
And I'm like,
there is a conference room name for me that I've never been in.
There it is. Look at that. We looked at it. And then we got to the back of the room. There was one person in there, and it was a writer. And
I think he's a producer. I think Andrew producer. Was there.
And so I was walking ahead of you because you stopped to collect your Emmys or something. And I walked up and looked in his office, and he looked up at me and gave me the same like, oh, hey.
Hey, but who hey. Are you?
And then I turned the corner and walked down the hall and he did, I think, did he stand up and come to the door?
Yeah, I think he came to check on what was going
like,
on.
What the hell? And then you were there and he was like, oh, hello. And we got a hero's welcome. But it did feel like one of those.
If you're just wandering through doors, John, as you often do, I'm sure you're used to the hey with a butt.
Hey.
Hey. But at the end, it kind of turns into,
yeah.
Hey.
Can I help you?
So, yeah, can I help you?
Yeah, there's some of
that. The least helpful phrase.
And I may have heard, can I help you, more times than your average person. Can I help you? How did you get here?
You're like, why does everybody say that to me?
I don't need any help. Why do I look like I need
why
help?
Why are you weirdos always saying, can I help you? Is that like your catchphrase?
But I was disappointed, and I've been on a couple of lots, you know, but I was disappointed that I didn't have that sort of Blazing Saddles experience of walking on the lot. And like you say, it was Roman gladiators and Bugsby Berkeley ice skaters.
You walk by the Bates Motel and somehow they're shooting Psycho. And then
yeah,
the
right.
next street, it's the Desperate Housewives street.
A couple of guys go by in a horse and carriage. It felt,
just a bunch of writers going to lunch.
Yeah. It felt kind of abandoned and also like there was something really missing, which was that feeling of old Hollywood. Everywhere I go when I'm down there, I'm looking for signs of the golden age of cinema.
You're looking for Lana Turner, and she's not there.
There's always a statue of Lana Turner made out of fiberglass in front of some like mock 50s diner, but I really want to see. And this is the thing. You go to Las Vegas and you're like, where's Sinatra's Vegas? It's like, it's all buried in a landfill. That stuff got torn down years ago.
Mostly because of the RICO Act. It's not mob related in LA, but yes.
Yeah. And in New York, of course, they tore down all of 19th century New York, but there's still all of 20th century New York is mostly still.
And if you like the theaters all still look crappy and old. So that's nice.
Yeah, that's nice. But yeah, and I guess downtown LA is exciting now, where it used to just feel like this is an abandoned and dangerous country.
They just, if something's abandoned and dangerous, they just call it the Arts District. And in some cases, actually pay to put transit there. And then it's nice and there's sushi.
Yeah, there's $400 or $4,000 a month studio apartment.
Exactly.
Yeah. But our story begins on the actual lot where you record your show.
This is nice. Yeah. I don't even have to commute today.
Yeah, this is your home turf. That lot, which is now the Sony lot, was the MGM lot.
It was.
There's still Metro Goldwyn Mayer film studio.
There's still, they say, a yellow brick somewhere from the yellow brick. I mean, there's one brick on the path they paint yellow to show the tours, I think. Because otherwise the tour is a little dull. It's like, here's Jeopardy and here's Wheel of Fortune.
Right next to each other.
And here's the Ghostbusters car and Walter White's car. And that's...
Yeah, right. Walter White's car.
That's what the kids want. You would not understand... If you bring Millennial and Down to Sony, you do not understand how all they want to see is the Breaking Bad RV and the Pontiac Aztec.
And then they're like, great.
That's it. Got my selfie. Got to go. But somewhere on a stage, supposedly under the flooring, there is still a little bit of the yellow brick road.
Oh, well, so many of the great films of the golden age of Hollywood were filmed there. MGM, one of the major studios prior to the mid-60s.
And there was a big backlot, by the way, across the street. Across Overland, I think, was what was the backlot where Gene Kelly sang In the Rain. And that's where all the fake city streets and stuff would have been that you'd recognize from any MGM musical. Sadly, now it's all tract homes and a Best Buy.
Yeah, it's crazy the number of films that were filmed there, all the way back to the silent movies. Charlie Chaplin and Laurel and Hardy filmed over on that lot.
Culver City was a weird nexus for film, like even before Burbank or anything was. Like even before MGM, I think Hal Roach set up shop there in the 20s. I think Harold Lloyd clung from the clock somewhere in what is now downtown Culver.
Right.
A lot of history there.
I think when I was staying at the Culver City Hotel, there's a picture of Harold Lloyd hanging from the clock with the implication sort of right there.
I wonder if it was. Well, that hotel has been there forever because that's famously where the Munchkin stayed.
Right.
So all the stories of Munchkin antics and orgies are centered on that hotel.
Oh, Munchkin orgies.
The weird thing about that hotel is they're always trying to tell you, and rumor has it that Charlie Chaplin and John Wayne both owned the hotel at different times. And I'm like, rumor has it? Like, that's...
Seems like that'd be
in the
paperwork.
Can't you just go to the county and ask if John Wayne ever owned this hotel?
There is some John Wayne memorabilia, but it's not in the hotel. It's in a window.
Oh, yeah.
In outside. Front of the hotel.
Yes, because they also have a Wizard of Oz little diorama there too, right?
The Wizard of Oz will play into our story.
I hope so.
John Wayne
for
doesn't
for
really.
Our gay listeners, it's going to be big.
There's a ton of this episode that will really appeal to Gen X and older gay listeners. I'm not sure younger gay listeners still identify with Judy Garland.
Do you guys care about Judy Garland? Let us know. We wanna be in touch with your culture. We just don't get invited to those parties.
From during our age, Judy Garland was basically what? Moses for gay people of Generation X era and older, I guess.
There's even like common gay legend to the fact that the Stonewall Riot was Judy Garland's birthday celebration.
Oh, really? Yeah. Originally?
It's either like a day off or the day of, but I think it turns out to be a coincidence.
That's pretty marvelous. Well, MGM, and you can probably speak to this as a movie buff and an old, like somebody that sits around and watches Technicolor films where people are singing and dancing and jumping on and off steam engines.
That's what I want.
Uh-huh.
I want a riverboat coming to town with singing and dancing going on both decks.
That's right.
That's all I look for. That's why I only watch TCM.
So how would you describe the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer era in Hollywood? Do you have a sense of the arc?
Yes. The funny thing is, like, they were one of the quality studios. You know, like Warner Brothers, who we now think of as the Titan, they were kind of making cheap gangster movies that everybody kind of was like, well, we shouldn't make a movie about a gangster.
Yeah, that's bad for the kids.
Surely they're doing crimes. But MGM was making lavish musicals, movies of all kinds. They're famous for their Technicolor musicals, but also, the earlier Busby Berkeley ones. A lot of great, rich New Yorkers with cigarette holders hanging out in beautiful Art Deco apartments.
Clark Gable, In and Out.
Yes. And also, like, I think maybe a lot of the big historical epics, I think. I'm not going to be 100% on which were which, but I wouldn't be surprised if, Mutiny on the Bounty and that kind of prestige historico-literary thing was MGM.
Mutiny on the Bounty was MGM.
Hey, good.
There you go.
Because they had Irving Thalberg. They had their kind of young super producer who was like really the first guy who was like a real dynamo. Like, I'm a producer, but I'm a creative, but I support the artists, but all my ideas are good.
Yeah.
So I'm like an auteur, even though I'm the guy giving notes because I'm young and cool. And he kind of revolutionized the studio.
Well, and as you can imagine, that made MGM – a titan of Hollywood all the way through kind of the studio code or the Hays Code era and through the Blacklist era even. And then in the 60s, filmmaking changed. Hollywood started to change. There was New Hollywood, right? When did New Hollywood start? Maybe not till a little bit later.
People usually say the year of Easy Rider.
Yeah,
so whatever that was, 67 or
67.
Something.
But you could, you know, there was a sea change starting, that there were no longer massive historical epics being made in the same vein. Ben-Hur kind of being the last of the big, like, chariot toga style.
Which I have previously said I'm always kind of allergic to.
You don't like the, how do you feel about
movies with sandals?
Cleopatra.
As a person?
No, I mean, I know we're both massive fans of Cleopatra as a person, but you know, like that kind of, that era.
I think that movie, yeah, like I think that movie almost bankrupted Fox, is that right?
Yeah.
And it took Sound of Music to save Zanuck at Fox. MGM tried, I know, because 2001 is an MGM movie. That it begins, but it doesn't begin with the lion. They had kind of turned it into a graphical blue and white lion that was not Leo, the guy who had been in the clips since the 20s, I think.
Yeah. They actually killed Leo to make the Cowardly Lion's costume.
Oh, no.
So there was a second Leo.
Is that why the lion's so cowardly? It's like cultural memory of his past murder.
Yeah, he's like, he feels it everywhere he goes.
I always do think that when the lion roars at the beginning of Wizard of Oz, I'm like, that's a missed opportunity. It should be the other lion.
Roar!
Roar, even. I'll pulverize them.
So by, you know, by the late 60s, it was sort of this time, I mean, 2001, but also there was a lot of new hipper cinema, a lot less costume drama, a lot more the Graduate style, younger, more... more Woody Allen inflected,
letting young directors cook, you know, like letting Mike Nichols do something that he had done on stage, or, The Godfather, you know, it's like those guys too, those Bay Area guys, Coppola and Lucas and Spielberg came out of that.
Yeah. So you started making movies as young guys, but also this was a period of the rise of television, and, not television as it had been in the 50s, but now television was in color.
It was hipper.
It was hipper.
Like television was where, you would go to laugh in to talk about the culture, not to a Marx Brothers movie.
Yeah, it was more flexible, a lot of stuff happening.
So the movies felt like they had to hip up as well, or they were going to be just for old people.
That's right. And one of the main characters of television in the 60s was James Aubrey, who was the head of CBS from 59 to 65. He was a young guy that came into CBS, and he had this sort of philosophy of television that it should appeal to the lowest common denominator. It should be fun. It should be sexy. It should be goofy. It should be kind of rural coded.
Oh, so this is because we did a show about all those shows going away, right?
Yeah.
We did an entry about Beverly Hillbillies getting the axe, but he was the guy behind that stuff.
Beverly Hillbillies, Green Acres, Gilligan's Island, a lot of that, the Munsters, like stuff that we think about as the, I mean, these were the...
That's the canon.
Yeah. And these were the sitcoms that were in reruns when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Like at my babysitter's when I was 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, the television was just a constant repeat of exactly these shows, Munsters, Gilligan's Island.
All those high concept sitcoms had a longer shelf life. Like kids today still watch Bewitched.
Yeah.
But they're not going to watch Make Room for Daddy. You know, like the ones that had the stupid gimmick at the time maybe seemed dumber, but actually... That turned out to be the ticket to immortality.
And these were culturally vilified at the time for all the predictable reasons. They were bad for kids. They, you know, Congress had hearings.
Really?
Or they were like, you can't possibly be. I mean, there were hearings about.
I would testify for the Munsters at that hearing. I would defend them.
I feel like there was some like, yeah, the monsters on the Munsters are, yeah, they're polluting kids' minds. But also then those shows started to transition to also having girls in bikinis on the shows. If you think about
the cleavage on Petticoat Junction,
that type of stuff. But what it did was make James Aubrey the most successful person in television. He took CBS from being sort of the second, the also-ran network, to being like number one in the ratings, so much so that executives at other networks, when studios announced, or when television studios, mm-hmm. right, is that networks, mm-hmm. when the networks announced the lineup of their new shows for the season, NBC and ABC waited for CBS to announce theirs so they could quickly juggle their schedule to see if they could. I mean, basically what they said at the time was that Aubrey was the program director for all three networks, because what he was bankrolling was kind of set the tone.
The last time I looked this up, if I remember right, CBS basically led in the ratings for literally decades. Like, it wasn't until ABC had that burst of Happy Days fueled pop culture success that CBS ever finished second to anybody.
It's funny to think about my own life as a television consumer, which would have been from birth. And my mom said that the first episode of Sesame Street, she sat me in my high chair as a, what would I have been, 9 months old?
69, yeah.
And said, here's a new show just for children. And she said, I watched every episode from the very first one. And those first Sesame Street episodes were extremely boring. They were, you know, a lot of people standing in front of a wall of cans talking about cans. I don't even, you know, have you ever watched episode 1, 2, and 3 of Sesame Street?
Yeah, but it's important for kids to know about cans.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, look, it played such a large role in my life later. but the number of times throughout, from the time I was born till the time I was 18, where you identified the era by whether you were watching CBS shows, ABC shows, or NBC shows.
Right. If it's like, NBC, it's got to be 84 or later.
Yeah, this is the NBC era.
Yeah.
So fun, but this was, you know, ABC was
ABC
in the
ABC is Happy
dominating.
Days and maybe Charlie's Angels. I can't remember. I have not been keeping score, John, but is it possible that Miracle Maid has brought more omnibus entries to our listeners than any other sponsor?
We've been loving Miracle Maid since many, many moons ago, and I still love my Miracle Maid sheets.
Literally moons, because we use our Miracle Maid by night.
It is a nighttime product.
Miracle Maid after dark.
I hardly ever take a nap in my bed. I'm more of a couch napper, but I love being in bed asleep.
Especially in Miracle Maid bedding.
It's the nicest.
You've probably heard this spiel before, because Miracle Maid has literally been supporting Omnibus for years.
I know about their NASA-inspired silver-infused fabrics that are temperature-regulating.
Well, you can do it. You're not even looking at the... Not even looking at the copy. You're just like looking right down the lens at me as you talk about silver infused fabrics.
I know that bacteria are often harbored in bed sheets.
Your sheets are gross, people.
Yeah, they are.
That's the Miracle Maid selling point. Your sheets are gross, and if you knew that, you would use something a little nicer.
Yeah, and I know that sheet bacteria, which is what we're calling it now, leads to allergies, stuffy noses, even acne.
The thing to know in summer is, like, this stuff is really good at temperature regulating.
You're talking about the silver infused NASA inspired fabrics of Miracle Maid.
They're thermoregulating. So, like, you can stay cool in the summer and warm in the winter. You'll sleep better.
And as a bachelor, let me tell you, the fact that Miracle Maid sheets prevent 99.7% of bacterial growth means you have to do less laundry.
As a bachelor, I want you to list for me the percentage of bacterial growth in every other part of your house. Go.
Well,
are they all way lower than 99.7?
Well, the thing is, all these books in the Omnibus library, they're all behind glass. So whatever bacteria they have on them is they took with them into the cupboards.
And do you think they're just going crazy in there, or do you think it's an anaerobic thing?
Well, looking at them, they all seem pretty clean. I know it's not anaerobic because air can get in there. But I do probably think that my couch where I take naps is not.
Maybe get some more Miracle Maid sheets for your couch.
For the couch?
Yeah, why not?
I wish that Miracle Maid made something that I could hose my couch down, but they don't.
NASA-inspired couch hoses. No, until that day, though, try those Miracle sheets. They are super comfortable. They're not expensive, but they feel like luxury hotel sheets, but not at that price point. It's amazing.
Yep. Yep. I feel like when I put my Miracle Maid sheets on, I feel like I'm just in the lap of luxury. So here's what you do. You go to trymiracle.com/omnibus. That's trymiracle.com/omnibus.
Try, like T-R-Y. Got it.
To try Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%.
That's a lot.
You basically can't afford not to have Miracle Made sheets.
But that's the end of the offer, right? There's nothing else?
No.
What?
No. If you use promo code OMNIBUS at checkout, you'll get a free three-piece towel set and save an extra 20%.
Holy cow, they just keep throwing perks at us, including unexpected things like a towel set.
What I'm saying is, again, buying Miracle Made sheets is basically like getting a free pile of stuff and also really nice sheets for way less than...
Imagine just buying something awesome and the clerk just throws in a towel set.
Yeah. Oh, would you like a towel set with that? Yes, thank you.
And you don't have to worry. Like, if you don't believe what we're saying, trust your own eyes, because there's a 30-day money-back guarantee with Miracle Made sheets. So you got a full refund at the end of the month if you're not 100% satisfied, but I think you will be.
So upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/omnibus and use the code OMNIBUS to claim your three-piece towel set and save over 40% off.
Again, that's trymiracle, trymiracle.com/omnibus to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for your longtime support of the Omnibus Project.
So by the late 60s, MGM had kind of fallen on hard times, I guess is the way to put it. They still had a reputation, or they had developed a reputation as kind of the fogey studio.
Do you know what you should look at if you're interested in this time? There's a documentary. Well, it's a documentary. It's a compilation film called That's Entertainment. Mm-hmm. Came out in 1974. And it's a simple idea. It's just like, what if we edit together all the big production numbers from the best MGM musicals and we'll put it back in theaters? And nobody believed in this thing. It took like one producer, basically disobeying his bosses to get it out. And it came out in 1974, and it was just a mega hit because audiences were like bummed by Watergate and the oil embargo. And suddenly you could go to the theater and see Fred Astaire dance or Gene Kelly dance.
Yeah.
Something that they had never been able to do, but they had heard about. And this thing made a bajillion dollars, and it's got these funny interstitials shot on the MGM lot, which is now our lot where we were hanging out. So you can see like that building where you and I recorded the Omnibus that day, the Harry Cohn building. You know, Sinatra will just walk out of there and see the camera and be like, oh, hello.
Hey there.
I'm here on the MGM lot. And they shoot on the back lot too, but it's totally in disrepair. You know, like yeah. Gene Kelly's like, well, this is, or Fred Astaire's like, this is the train station from the Bandwagon. But now the trains don't come by here much anymore. They're all hamming it up. But you can really see it's the sets are kind of falling apart.
Yeah, the Bee Gees recorded their Stayin' Alive music video in 1977 on the lot, which was crumbling.
Really?
And you can see that. You can watch the Stayin' Alive music video. It's pretty impressive.
You can tell by the way they use their lot?
You can. It's a woman's something. No time to talk.
Exactly.
Yeah. And they didn't have any time to talk. They just sang and got out of there.
But yeah, it's fun to see our lot in disrepair.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Well, and that was really true, right? The
cool Art Deco buildings are still there, but they're in better shape.
And that lot that we're describing that had, I mean, if you watch, there are some compilations where they show, and maybe it's taken from that movie, but they're just sort of YouTube 10-minute shorts where they show the shot from the big movie, from It's a Wonderful Life, and then they show it with the curtains blowing in the wind and the windows all broken. And it's astonishing the number of films where it seems like it's a real location. It seems like it's really a town filmed in Arizona or something filmed on a Chicago street.
New York.
And it's just people with rain hoses standing just out of camera shot, just raining on
in Culver City.
Yeah, at night in Culver City.
It was so rare to go on location back then. You can really tell when movies do go to New York, you're kind of just jolted out of it because it feels so contemporary.
And that was part of this 60s, the transition to real locations and this more flexible, in some ways, smaller scale, cheaper filmmaking in a lot of ways that. But so the late 60s come around, and what MGM had was obviously a famous brand. They had the Lion, and they had tons and tons and tons of property. And a lot of it property that was like pretty
not
pretty
the, not the land, but actually
no land.
Oh, I see.
Primarily land. Yeah, it's basically the Sears story, where Sears as a company failed to keep up with the times, and but Sears as a like a corporate entity owned billions of dollars of property, in some cases right in the center of cities, but also, you know, these huge tracts of suburban land where Sears had built big malls. And so for Sears to go out of business, they become, this is how corporate raiders work, right? They would go in, they'd look at a company.
Look at all that real estate. If they didn't have these stores there, this company would be amazing.
But like the stock price is reflective of the business, but it doesn't take into consideration this incredible bank of stuff. And so corporate raiders would go in, buy the company by buying the stock at a low price, and then they would break the company
destroy
up
it.
And,
yeah.
and sell everything off and make millions and sometimes more.
Good for them.
Yeah.
That's American know-how. That's what made this country great.
And
private
that's
equity.
What happens here?
Oh, no.
Because you're a man of your time, probably remember the character Kirk Kerkorkian.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Wow. That takes me back. I haven't thought of that name in a long time.
Or I'm sorry, Kerkorkian.
Kerkorkian.
Yeah. Not Kerkorkian.
Kirk Kerkorkian would be funnier.
Yeah, it is. But and
should we just say that?
My instinct is to always, you know, lean harder into the mispronunciation. But Kirk Kerkorkian was his family were Armenian immigrants. And as you know, California has the largest population of Armenians outside of Armenia.
California is running an Armenian surplus.
It's a lot.
They export Armenians to the rest of the world.
And
even Armenia.
I think that's true. I think probably the largest number of immigrants to Armenia.
The two biggest Armenian cities are whatever the capital of Armenia is and Fresno.
Yeah. But Kerkorkian was the child of Armenian immigrants. He grew up in eventually in California. You know, they kind of moved around. But he grew up dirt poor, just absolutely dirt poor, and was sort of making a living. But he was ambitious, and he got into boxing as a kid. He was like he was a real scrapper and somebody that wanted to make a name for himself in the world, but, you know, unclear how he would do it. He had no resources of any kind, but he gradually taught himself. He went to see like a biplane demonstration and fell in love with flying, taught himself how to fly.
Wow.
And
barnstormers changing lives.
That's right. And he turned into a little bit of a barnstormer, opened a flight school, and was already sort of building like an airplane empire. And then World War II came, and Kerkorkian volunteered for the Royal Air Force before the U.S. was in the war.
Right. Yeah, a lot of American pilots did that.
And then was a pilot who flew, you know, across the world's oceans, over the Burma hump, you know, was a pilot throughout the war. And then came back after the war and did a thing I've always been really curious about, why this wasn't maybe more common. Because at the end of World War II, there was this enormous surplus of materiel, right? During the war, thousands of airplanes were manufactured, ships, tanks. There's only so many tanks you can sell to other places, but ships and planes still had a lot of value. But most of that stuff was junked. But Kerkorkian saw an opportunity and bought a lot of airplanes, specifically surplus, and sold them to other countries, not just, or maybe not war planes at all, but transport planes. He started a reselling business of war surplus. And then in California, started his own sort of off-the-books airline that gradually became a real airline.
Is called, it like an airline we have heard of? Or?
Well, it was called Trans International Air or Transatlantic International Air, something to that effect.
Yeah.
And it ended up being absorbed into a larger airline. He sold, in other words. And he was a good wheeler dealer. And by the 60s.
I never know what that means.
A like, wheeler and a dealer?
Yeah, I can see somebody dealing. If you're good at business, you're dealing. But in what sense are they wheeling?
Well, wheeling sort of sounds like wheedling or.
So you think it's wheeler-deedler?
No, wheeler-dealer.
I mean, wheel is a verb, but what does that mean? He's like spinning around with his arms out? He's like, wee, let's do business.
Isn't it an archaic phrase to mean like, oh, he was wheeling me a deal?
Is that
it,
right?
It just rhymes with deal.
Is that the only thing?
I think it is, okay. Yeah. I think it's just a...
Well, it might have stuck around because so many of the products we associate with a wheeler dealer are wheeled.
Hmm.
You know, you
sure.
Like you think of a car lot.
Yeah, you're going to, oh, maybe that's it. Maybe it's that he's I wheel out of here after having made a deal.
I deal you wheels?
He wheeled in. He wheeled in and dealt.
He welt and dealt. I don't think that's where it's from, but who even knows?
Yeah, it's this is something for someone who studies these things in college at the University of Iowa and who has a PhD in
I'm sure there have been lengthy slang. Articles. Here's somebody saying it.
The derivation.
It may originate in the American West because it was gamblers. It's a roulette wheel, not a transport wheel at all.
Interesting.
Because wheeler and dealer are both like gambling activities.
Sure.
So it just implies you're a little bit maybe shady. A wheeler dealer is not a good businessman. He's
a shady one.
He's by flying by the seat of his pants.
Or at least, if not shady, then at least you know what it.
I don't want to imply that about Kirk Kerkorkian. No. I don't want the Armenians coming after me.
No, we'll get to that.
Okay.
But I think what it means is that instead of being someone who has a trade, you're someone who goes from one thing to the next.
That's true.
Your deal. The deal is the job. And now in America, that's what we think of as...
The president.
Yeah, that's right. But also, I mean, entrepreneurs often are not focused on what they're making.
Yeah.
They're focused on going from thing to thing, and they actually never made anything, or they made one thing and turned it into...
It's great.
100 things. Yeah, that's great. That's why capitalism is so successful now. Such a shining... A city on a hill.
Real high point for capitalism.
But so Kerkorkian is in Hollywood and by all accounts is not especially cultural, like does not care about the movies as an institution, isn't a lover of show business, but he sees in MGM... one of these, I mean, he's the proto corporate warrior. He sees that MGM has a lot of resources or a lot of property, there's a lot of money in MGM.
Even though it's underperforming.
And the studio is underperforming and the studio feels like on the verge of bankruptcy. And there's these young guns of show business that feel like all this stuff is the trash of the past and we're going to make movies from now on in a spaghetti Western fashion. Maybe it's all going to be car chases from here on out, but probably what it isn't going to be is enormous set pieces on back lots. We're going to do much more or maybe all filming on location. And this stuff is just wasted space. Culver City's booming. Although Culver City, in my experience, was only started booming in the last 5 years.
It is booming now, but I think Kerkorkian might have pulled the trigger a little early.
Yeah, there was not what seemed like much going on in Culver City 10 years ago.
But is that what leads to the backlot getting sold off?
Well, so...
I guess that doesn't happen until the 70s. But.
Kerkorkian buys MGM and immediately puts James Aubrey... in the top spot. Now what happened?
Aubrey leaves CBS.
What happened is Aubrey got way out over his skis at CBS. He was Aubrey took over CBS as a result of the game show scandals.
Oh, really?
The game show scandals sort of forced all the top leadership out. He took over, but the company, the chairman of the board was William Paley. And Paley had kind of uncharacteristically for both himself and the time let Aubrey have free reign of programming. But Paley did not like the dumbing down of programming.
Yeah, because he was from the Tiffany Network days where CBS was prestige.
That's exactly right. And he was always, you know, like very afraid that Aubrey was going to put the network in real jeopardy, because Aubrey was also a playboy in the style of the time. He probably was not, he would not pass any kind of Me Too litmus test, but also he was, talk about sketchy, he was taking kickbacks from production companies. He was taking kickbacks for the shows that he was making on. So he was being paid a salary, but he was also like
unbeknownst to his bosses.
He was like living in a Manhattan townhouse that was being paid for by one of the producer or the production companies of his shows.
That seems like the kind of thing you could get in trouble for even back then if your bosses find out.
Yeah. And people found out about it and it made its way back to the top brass. And this was used eventually. He was at some party at Jackie Gleason's house or something where the cops raided it. And that was enough of a scandal that they used it as a reason to fire him. Kerkorian buys MGM and puts Aubrey in the top spot. And Aubrey says, it's time to clean house. It's time to streamline MGM and get rid of all of this, this dead weight. And it's hard to imagine a time. It's hard probably for us to imagine a time when the ephemera of the great era of Hollywood would be thought of as so much trash. But it's also hard to imagine a time when Penn Station in New York would be seen as just a big pile of garbage to be replaced with Madison Square Garden.
Yeah. So you're saying there was not much of a market for memorabilia at the time?
So prior to this period, late 60s, early 70s, film buffs collected autographs and posters, but there wasn't.
They were also oddballs with like Creature from the Black Lagoon posters in their basements. They were not moneyed collectors like we imagine, you know, somebody buying Rosebud today.
Right. And that was largely, I think, still a holdover from the idea that all movies and television were some kind of pretty gross, like low-brow culture.
And transitory, right? Like if you wanted to see King Kong, you had to wait for it to come on TV. You couldn't be a fan of a movie and you know, watch it at home on home video.
Yeah, right. It was in theaters, and then the studios and the theaters couldn't wait to move on to the next film.
Yeah.
So to even be somebody that was like, I love the Creature of Black Lagoon. It's like, really?
Yeah.
Have you seen any movies since then? So there was an autograph culture, but there hadn't yet really developed any kind of culture around not only Hollywood collectibles, but collectibles.
Today we'd be like, I wonder who owns Luke's lightsaber. And back then you would be like, well, nobody owns props. They just got used in a movie and thrown away.
Yeah, that's right. And if you think about all the stuff that was used in the making of Star Wars that just got put in a dumpster, that now would be worth $1 trillion because there are people. I saw an auction not very long ago selling Star Wars stuff. And honestly, that's like lot 742, a piece of foil that fell off of a land speeder.
Yeah.
And it's just like, wow, it's $750 really for a piece of, but you'd put it in a frame on your, you know, on the wall and be like, you know, that was in the original Star Wars.
It comes with a certificate. I was keeping an eye on David Lynch's estate sale because my son had sent it to me. We're both big fans. And I was kind of excited because it was estimating, hey, his coffee cup will probably go for $150. And I was like, well, maybe I should get something here, you know?
And did you?
Literally everything went for like a five-figure sum. Like it was insane. Like stuff literally went for a 500 multiplier over what people were thinking. Like, well, these are extra insulation pads from his water heater. Like, and that was like the lowest thing. And it was like $800 or something. Yeah. Like everybody just wanted a piece of history, and it's become mass culture in a way that it wasn't before to collect. Were you the one that sent me that listing that had like, or did I send this to you that had like Indiana Jones's whip and, you know, the Gray's Sports Almanac from Back to the Future 2 and the sketch of the flux capacitor. We were looking at that stuff,
right?
Yeah,
we were. And that was not that long ago. And, you know, the whip sold for multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
Because it was the same whip that was used in
all three
Indiana
hero
Jones.
Whip,
it
as
was
they say.
The whip. Yeah, it's crazy to think that there weren't seven of them.
There are props that go for seven digit sums now, which is nuts.
But I think in 1970, for instance, there were people that had Napoleon's hat.
Like the real Napoleon.
Yeah,
right?
Like this is Napoleon's hat.
Yeah, the idea that you would own a historical artifact, for sure.
Yeah, people were collecting Roman coins. All those soldiers that went into the Eagle's Nest and took Hitler's photo albums, a lot of that stuff just ended up in attics. I mean, it wasn't, these were just middle class soldiers that brought Hitler's tableware back and stuck it in a box. That stuff continues.
Well, who do you have over and serve on the Third Reich dinnerware? You know,
it was a plot point in American Beauty.
It was. Chris Cooper is a collector. I'm just saying, if I had it, I would also hide it in the attic.
Yeah. So I think collectors were interested in historical memorabilia, but movies weren't yet seen in that light as historical. And so what it turned out was part of the process of selling off the assets of MGM. What Kerkorian wanted was the name. Kerkorian thought of himself at that point as a real estate investor and a hotelier. And
oh, interesting.
What he wanted was the MGM name.
Oh, which they did.
For hotels.
They did do that, right?
They absolutely did. And so with James Aubrey in charge, his idea was, let's clean house. Let's literally clean house. Let's sell off all this property and all this garbage and streamline MGM, take the name, basically split it up. And we'll sell this part of it to these ding-dongs for whatever, pennies on the dollar. And
just different divisions of the company and different real estate holdings and stuff?
Exactly. Okay. And so Aubrey says, one of the things we have to do is tear down all of these New York street scenes and sell these backlots for subdivisions.
To developers,
Yeah, like get rid of this stuff. And in order to do it, we have to get these warehouses of crap.
It's just props and costumes.
Props and costumes and garbage.
Set pieces.
Well, those props and costumes constituted an astonishing collection of the history of film. All of the chariots and covered Conestoga wagons, whole rooms full of like armor, shining armor, spears, like racks and racks and racks of rifles.
So some of it's beautiful and some of it's like cinematically significant.
Yeah.
And but, there's just a ton of it.
But also rooms of racks of clothes that were used in Showboat, that were used in The Wizard of Oz, all of the Munchkins' costumes, all of Judy Garland's, you know, there were five pairs of ruby slippers from the making of The Wizard of Oz.
And do they realize what they have? Like, Is it the kind of thing where nobody has discovered that you can sell the ruby slippers to a Smithsonian-level collector?
That's right. There were there were people in Hollywood who felt very strongly about this stuff, that this was the history of cinema and that it—
You're basically breaking up a museum.
Well, and there were people that believed there should be a museum of Hollywood. One of the kind of most prominent costume designers was a man named Kent Warner, who was very conscious of, like, these are significant. And he because he was a designer and saw, there was already a sense that maybe the original Vinci's were things to preserve, you know, that these things had a value.
Even
on a
if they hadn't
market.
Been worn by a star, they're still designer fashion.
That's right. And so, but he was also somebody, I mean, there were a lot of people in across all the studios that would kind of walk through and say, wait a minute, is that the, like, the toga that was worn by Kurt Russell?
Probably Kirk Douglas, but yes.
I'm sorry. Is that the toga that was worn by Kirk Douglas? Could have been Kirk. I guess Kurt Russell never wore a toga, did he?
He would have been a kid at the time.
Yeah. Oh, you know, he was wearing white corduroy pants because he was...
He was the computer that wore corduroy pants.
That's right. Ken, I know that you look young. You look much younger than your true age of 1,900.
Perpetually youthful.
Yeah.
Because of all the other people whose life energy I drain. Uh-huh. Pretty much anybody who meets me becomes a husk.
But I, as a middle-aged guy, am really starting to show my age. And, you know, we both have been around the sun enough times that we've experienced some of the gradual decay that comes with being a human being.
Being out in the sun while we were going around the sun. But are you like me? Did you just have an amazing product show up at your front door?
Well, I did get a very interesting new, skin softener, like a cream. I don't usually use them, but this is the first moisturizer that is proven to target senescent cells.
What are senescent cells? Oh, like aging, right?
Well, yeah, and these are cells that are, they're not trying to, like, wipe away the effects of dead cells. They're actually trying to target cells that still have their life force in them, right?
That's what makes you look wrinkly.
Yeah,
right?
This is the root cause of wrinkles and crepiness and loss of elasticity, which are kind of key signs of skin aging. And the results have been validated in 5 published clinical studies.
So this is the only, they have patented this OS1 peptide.
OS1 peptide, exactly.
Yeah, so I had a bunch of these show up in the mail, and my wife immediately spirited the way.
That's right. In fact, she was just commenting how much softer it made her skin. And
yes, she's only been using them for a few days, and she already said, and apparently these results are just going to get better over time. Smoother, firmer skin, you're going to look healthier.
This is crazy. They have over 10,000 5-star reviews. OneSkin's products are pretty universally beloved.
Mindy's very picky about moisturizers, just given the number of, like, three-quarters full moisturizers we have in our bathroom closet.
Sure, and you guys are, you know, the type of wealthy
stuff.
Americans that buy skin.
Blow so much money on this crap. But not OneSkin, which, by the way, I was saying Oneskin.
When did you ever say Oneskin?
I'm just kidding. I did not say Oneskin. It's OneSkin. But it's good for sensitive skins. It doesn't have over 1,500 harsh or irritating ingredients. Wow, they're counting the number of harsh or irritating ingredients they don't have, but which other brands apparently do.
Well, and there are a lot of, like, who are those people? Biohackers who are trying to, like, figure out the science behind staying young and vibrant.
And they love this stuff.
They love this stuff, like Dave Asprey. And then also famous people like Jennifer Aniston and Katy Perry are also on the list.
Game show host Ken Jennings.
Ken Jennings' wife, Mindy, all OneSkin endorsers.
My goal is to be so famous that sentence becomes Jennifer Aniston, game show host Ken Jennings, and Katy Perry.
Well, and here's the thing. At the helm of this iconic skincare brand is their founding all-woman team of longevity scientists with backgrounds in stem cell biology, skin regeneration, and tissue engineering.
Slay.
That's right.
All of their products are designed to layer seamlessly or replace multiple steps in your routine. So like your whole moisturizing regimen is going to get like easier and smarter as you age. That sounds great.
OneSkin is the world's first skin longevity company, targeting cellular aging to keep your skin and scalp looking and acting younger for longer.
For a limited time, you can try OneSkin with 15% off using code Omnibus at oneskin.co. That's 15% off oneskin.co. Just use code Omnibus.
After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about it. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Try OneSkin today. Your future self will thank you.
Tell them Ken and John sent you.
And so people were kind of, that worked at the studios were to some degree pocketing things because none of the studios seemed to value it. I mean, if you think about the way the studios treated just the acetate originals of some of the great films.
Yeah.
Lost. A lot of them got recycled for the silver content. Many of them just got thrown in dumpsters.
So today we're still watching prints from dupes because the camera negative's gone.
That's right. And some of those camera negatives are preserved, but in order to put them onto safety film, it's like $5 a foot. Mm. Just to process this decaying film stock.
Right. And there was no restoration was really not yet even an industry.
Yeah. I mean, Johnny Carson took over the production of The Tonight Show when he realized that all the first decade of The Tonight Show had just been taped over. And you never see black and white footage of Carson, even though he did that show for a decade with all of the stars.
The Art Fleming Jeopardy is gone too. When I hear stories like that, I always wonder if the star is actually a futurist who's like, this will have value and you don't have imagination, or if it's just ego. If they're like, you copied over my show? That was my show. Maybe it's a little of both.
I think Carson understood that because that was the era of reruns.
Right.
And by that point in time, you realize how profitable reruns are. And you're like, are you kidding me? We could rerun this show. You remember when the Dean Martin roasts were a thing you could buy on VHS, right?
Yeah.
And that idea that the thing
I was always buying those and the Girls Gone Wild tapes. If any infomercial for a videotape, I would buy.
And they're great back to back. You show 5 minutes of one, you pop it out,
ready for Dean Martin.
So they realize, well, we got to get this stuff out of here. And there is enough of a market for it that people were like, wait a minute, don't just throw it in a dumpster. And an auctioneer by the name of David Weitz bought the entire contents of the MGM lot.
What? You could just sell it to one auctioneer?
7 sound stages.
I assumed he would take a cut. He just bought it.
Bought everything. 7 sound stages worth of everything, including the full-sized ship from the Mutiny of the Bounty.
Wow.
Mutiny on the Bounty.
They just kept the Bounty.
The full, and it's just sitting, you know, on a lot in a pond.
It doesn't need to have a pond. I guess maybe it does.
Well, it was built in the pond, you know, and the full-sized paddle wheel boat from Showboat. But all of this stuff, tanks, there was a working locomotive. Every film you see where a steam locomotive pulls into a station, it's this.
That's the one that was on the lot.
Famous locomotive. All this stuff, you know, kind of works. It works enough to pull it off in a film. Like the locomotive that they had on the lot was built in the 1880s. It had served for 60 years in actual locomotive service, was retired, but it dated to the cowboy years. So they bought it and when they would film cowboy movies on site, like in Montana, they would actually put the locomotive on a train, carry it up to Butte.
Like it wouldn't be a car. It would be like mounted on a flat car.
Yeah. When they put it up on a flat car, they'd take it up there. They'd set it on the tracks. They'd get it running, you know, and film these scenes. So all this stuff was there. If you think about 7 lots.
Wow.
And David Weitz bought it for $1.5 million in 1970 dollars.
So that's, you know, a high seven-figure amount today, but I assume that's going to be pennies on the dollar based on what happens.
Well, so I think that Aubrey and Kerkorian felt like, I don't think they thought, this guy, we rooked him here. But they thought, meh, you know, he'll make a little profit selling this stuff. And so they announced this auction. And honestly, it's the first time anybody had heard of the possibility of, like, you mean I could have a candlestick from...
from the movie I saw?
Yeah, from these movies. Like, that's cool. Like,
I'll be touching something that Charles Lawton touched.
And so they opened up the lots for previews. They published multiple catalogs showcasing all this stuff. They opened up the studios for people to come preview the stuff. And in LA, it was kind of an event. Lots of people, even now in the fan community, people in, you know, late middle age or in their dotage
or older,
will describe the experience of walking through all, you know, multiple days walking through and just like, wow, look at that. Oh my God, look at that. Most of those people then didn't return as bidders. The first day of the auction, there was kind of a dealer's auction where people that were buying kind of bigger items.
Resell, maybe?
To resell big lots, I think.
Yeah.
Not the store, but...
The store big lots did not come.
But one of the people that was most deeply involved in the auction and out of a position of someone who recognized these things were important artifacts, very valuable to the world, and she was extremely offended by the way MGM was being treated, was Debbie Reynolds.
Huh.
And Debbie Reynolds...
she starred in some of those musicals.
She did. She was in Singing in the Rain.
Mm-hmm.
Mother of Carrie Fisher. So, of course, we're going to keep coming back to a Star Wars connection. But Debbie Reynolds had for a long time at that point been arguing for a Hollywood museum. She thought that Hollywood deserved like the museum treatment and all of these things belonged in these displays. When we were just in Florence, Firenze, as we like to say.
Firenze.
As you and I like to say. We went to a museum display, you know, as a floor of the museum that was just the costumes, the costume culture and the fashion, basically, of the last, well, since the earliest garment that they've found that survived, right? So it was, you walk through the museum and it's like
Italian fashion from back to Rome.
Almost. Yeah, here are sort of the Medici era costumes and we still have them and they're under glass and all the way through to the present day. So Debbie Reynolds had this vision and she was trying to fund this museum. She wanted the studios to chip in and this seemed like such a logical thing for her. And it was an era of malaise. And
nobody had ready money.
Yeah, nobody wanted to do this, what seemed like nostalgic.
That was the thing. Nobody could get That's Entertainment made because everyone's like, who cares about the MGM musicals of the 40s and 50s? Right. College kids don't want to see this. This is a dying part of our art form. And turned out there was a huge market for it, but the studios were the last ones to know.
And so Debbie Reynolds is there right in the front row. And the fact that she's there, she has still a lot of star power.
Yeah.
And of all the actors whose costumes and props are represented in these auctions, some of them kind of wandered through, but she was the only one that was there and buying.
Is she buying her own stuff or?
She's buying everything she can. Mm. She raises some money from, I think she leverages her house and gets a bank loan. And spends $186,000 buying everything she can. She buys Marilyn Monroe's dress, not just Marilyn Monroe's dress from Gentlemen for Fur Blondes, but the famous Subway dress, you know,
7 Year Itch.
From 7 Year Itch. She buys like Judy Garland's dress from Wizard of Oz keeps coming up because even by then, Wizard of Oz was a cult film.
That was the one that the people rewatched on TV and that kids grew up loving, even though it was old.
And it may have already been a gay, like, secret coded.
For sure.
Yeah.
So there's a secret hairdresser audience to buy that stuff.
So she sat along with all these other bidders and just buying what she could. And racks of costumes, you know, things that, and she bought Audrey Hepburn's little black dress from Breakfast at Tiffany's. Like, she was very conscious about trying to preserve as much as she could. If you think about $186,000 at a time when many of these things were going for $50, $100, like Johnny Weissmuller's loincloth from Tarzan, $50.
Hasn't been washed, probably.
The Cowardly Lion's costume, actually made out of lion, was for sale. Liz Taylor's dress from Father of the Bride. Like, just so much stuff. Clark Gable's trench coat.
Do you think she's buying this still with dreams of her museum?
Yes, absolutely. She's like, this stuff belongs in a museum. I'm going to build this museum. Eventually, she sort of does. But a lot of things, like things you would not, like, well, who's going to buy the Bounty? It's literally a life-size ship.
Hard to store.
But the Bounty, which the ship was actually named the Victrix, and the boat from Showboat were both bought by Lamar Hunt, who was already then a millionaire who'd sort of made his money. He owned the Chiefs. Where were the Chiefs from? St. Louis.
Kansas City.
Kansas City, that's right. Kansas City Chiefs.
He's got that. And although back then, that's probably not where most of his money was. What was he? He was like has he come up in a previous, like,
Lamar Hunt
Wall Street episode? I guess he's mostly a sports guy.
He started the like soccer league. He started the ultimate football.
Yeah, no, I'm
league.
Right. We didn't do cornering the silver market, but we did cornering the orange market or something.
Well, is he one of the Hunt brothers from the Texas Hunt brothers that did corner the silver market?
Yeah.
This Hunt.
Yeah. This dog Will Hunt.
Right. So he was the other brother, not the Nelson and the William. Hunt.
So there's two that the trading places is based on, and then there's this younger brother who's mostly into Midwestern football.
Yeah, he's not one of the chubbier Hunts, but you know, Hunt is the guy that actually, like, coined the term Super Bowl.
Oh yeah, because he founded the AFL. Yeah. Yes, that's right.
So he was a big, like, a hot shot, but he wanted to open an amusement park in Kansas City. Because this
everybody's
was
dream.
Yeah, this was an era of big booming, like, amusement parks. So he opened Worlds of Fun and next door Oceans of Fun. And he bought both the Bounty and Showboat to be moved from their pond at MGM to a new pond.
At Oceans of Fun.
At Oceans of Fun.
I would assume Worlds is more fun than Oceans of Fun. What sounds bigger to you?
I feel like if you're going to make an amusement park.
I only have one day. I'm going to go to Worlds of Fun.
Oceans of Fun. Maybe you don't want to be in a double landlocked state like like St. Louis, or I'm sorry, Missouri. Don't know. But so he was there buying stuff. There were a lot of other people buying stuff, but a lot of the stuff didn't sell. And at that point, they just had a rummage sale. And this was still an era. 1970, I base all sort of youth fashion on what the Rolling Stones were wearing at any given time. And
it might mislead you sometimes.
Yeah, 66, 67, 68, a lot of, if you look at the Rolling Stones, they're all trying to be Sgt. Pepper. 1970 was an interesting transition year. Because denim and hippie, you know, tattered clothes were coming on, but people were still wearing Sergeant Pepper-y kind of flamboyant, like a lot of guys in blouses with flourish. And so this stuff went out to rummage sales, and people were buying it kind of by the pound. Stuff,
all these kids just wanting proto-glam.
Yeah. Stuff being cut up and repurposed into some sort of fringe jacket, except with lace from one of the costumes from Showboat.
Yeah.
But also people buying things, recognizing like, oh, this is the candelabra from this film, and I'm going to keep it on my shelf.
So it could have been some number of kind of Forrest Ackerman-style weirdos who were actually looking for props for movies they like.
What it did was it, in some ways, the 1970 MGM auction invented the concept of collecting memorabilia from pop culture things.
We probably didn't even use the word memorabilia much. It was like, it was probably your personal life. This is my memorabilia from college.
Yeah, wouldn't have been even a concept, right? And so if you think about like original Beatles lyrics, I mean, the only reason we have them is that Paul put them in his pocket and took them home. But there's so much stuff from the era prior to this realization that's just lost, just was considered crap. Just throw it away.
I have a friend that collects game show set pieces from TV shows. And yeah, he just took stuff from dumpsters because the original set of Family Feud was going to go. And he was like, not on my watch.
So the Victrix sold for $15,000, which was the highest bid item.
How much was it?
$15,000, except for the auction of Judy Garland's
the ruby slippers from
Ruby Slippers.
Wizard of Oz.
So there were multiple pairs of ruby slippers. One pair had been given away as part of a contest years prior in the 50s. Some teenage girl got second place in a call-in radio contest, and her prize was a pair of the ruby slippers, which she put in a box and at the top of her closet and kept there until these slippers. Two of the pairs of slippers actually got pocketed by Kent Warner. And Kent Warner worked with the auction to kind of put the main costumes on display. He actually...
To tell them what might...
Yeah.
Big ticket items.
He was like, this is actually a thing. This is actually a thing. And he took a couple of ruby slippers. So this pair of ruby slippers was sort of presented as the pair of ruby slippers. And...
Do we know if, in fact, it was the hero pair from the heel-clicking scene?
There were a couple, right? There were ones that she wore, and then there was the close-up pair.
The ones coming off the witch's feet, I guess,
yep.
And the ones she clicks.
And I think all five are sort of were worn in scenes. Maybe there's one pair that never got used in a scene.
Do we know? I mean, just to jump ahead, I think, today one's in the Smithsonian, right?
Yeah. One's in the Smithsonian, one's in the hand of, or maybe a couple are in the hands of private collectors. One pair is still missing. I mean, they're all accounted for. Mm. But the fact that those they ended up selling for $15,000, the same price as the Bounty. And that was the beginning of the idea that, what?
This is a revenue stream.
Like these are worth that?
This isn't the boat.
Yeah, it shocked everybody. But by then the auction, you know, all this stuff was gone, sold. And then the rummage sale type of thing, none of that seemed like, well, this wasn't. I mean, somebody reports finding a pea coat and inside it's embroidered Clark Gable and they bought it for $5 or something. There was quite a bit of that, I think, that you could. And what's amazing is to think that all of that stuff probably ended up in people's houses and then
trotted out to show guests.
Well, but maybe not. Maybe grandma died and had,
nobody knew.
Yeah, had it stopped just got talking.
Thrown away. Nobody knew that it was some dress that whoever had worn.
Yeah, the hero
Ginger candelabra. Rogers had worn or something.
Well, so Kerkorian, just to race through it here at the end, Kerkorian tore it apart. And then took the MGM name as a hotel name, and then...
MGM Grand, right, in Vegas?
MGM Grand, which he opened in 1973.
Which vaguely had, for a while, had a Wizard of Oz theme. You could visit a lion, it had a hot air balloon in the lobby, I remember.
So what he did was, many of the things that didn't sell, he actually, or they, took and sold in the gift shop at the MGM Hotel in Vegas. You could go into the gift shop and they'd be like, yeah, this was the original, you know, these are the other slippers. These are some kind of, you know, this is a Munchkin hat. Or they saw it as having value, but it was, there was so much of it still, and it had, you know, tourist value.
This is like Hard Rock Cafe doesn't exist without this, huh?
That's right. Planet Hollywood. Yeah. This is all based on that same concept. Kerkorian kind of, you know, broke apart the company. In 1981, he actually bought, this timeline is somewhat jumbled. In 76, Kerkorian bought 25% of Columbia Pictures.
Which is why, yeah, Sony and Columbia are now one. Let's see what happens next.
Well, so
does Sony buy Columbia, or?
He survived, he was sued by, I mean, Columbia, the other owners of Columbia did not like that he was there. They'd seen what he did to MGM. He was sued the feds came after him on an antitrust grounds, but he won the case. And then he sold his 25% stake in Columbia Pictures for a $70 million profit in 1980. He sold a lot of the MGM lot to Lorimar, which was absorbed by Warner Brothers. And then Warner Brothers sold it to Sony TriStar. Mm. In 81, Kerkorian bought United Artists and then sold both MGM and United Artists to Ted Turner for $1.5 billion.
I was just watching James Caan in Thief, and it opens with, I think it's 81 or 82, it opens with the MGM logo and then the UA logo spins out. And I was like, oh yeah, I remember this era.
Yeah.
Saw this before Octopussy, I think.
So what Turner did was he bought them not for any of MGM's physical assets. What he wanted was for Turner Classic Movies, proto...
He wanted rights to the old movies.
Yeah, he wanted the intellectual property. So he stripped off...
That guy is a futurist, I think. He, like, he knew what he was getting.
He did. He stripped off MGM and pre-1950 Warner Brothers movies... And then sold it 5 months later back to Kerkorian, who was using the MGM name. He sold United Artists back to him. And Kerkorian, like, also got, at this point, I think, ended up with the MGM lot again. Then in 1990, he sold MGM. But he kept the rights to MGM to use in his hotels.
The naming rights.
But he sold it for $1.4 billion to an Italian investor named Giancarlo Peretti, who bankrupted because he couldn't make it fly. Yeah. You know, there were some hits for MGM along the way in the 80s, right? There was Kramer versus Kramer or that type of thing.
Okay.
Then he defaulted to Credit Lyonnais, who tried to find a buyer and then sold it back to Kerkorian in 96.
This guy's whole career is just rebuying MGM.
At this point, he's bought it three times. He decides he's actually going to try and make it a go as a studio. So he buys Orion. He buys Samuel Goldwyn. He buys the Motion Picture Corporation of America. He buys PolyGram, and then in 2005, he sold it again. And whatever survives of MGM.
I know who owns MGM now. Did
tell
you
me
that?
Tell me who.
Amazon.
Amazon bought MGM.
Because they have the Bond rights now. And the funny thing is their studio is just down the street. They bought what used to be the old Selznick studio less than a mile from the old MGM. And so I guess if MGM has offices, it's somewhere there on that little Amazon lot, just a mile from where it was born.
Isn't that incredible?
And then Jeff Bezos is going to take over the Bond movies, and the bad guys will just be
They won't be tech entrepreneurs
anymore.
They
for sure won't be tech entrepreneurs.
They'll probably be woke.
It'll be whoever, yeah, whoever Bezos is annoyed at. Right. Waiters who want big tips or marina people who say his yacht won't fit or something.
Debbie Reynolds, at that point, tried to make a go of it as someone who had her own Museum of Hollywood. Nobody in Hollywood ever kind of rallied behind her. So she went to Vegas. She bought in 1992, after years of, I mean, people were aware of her collection and she was very open about it. In 1992, she bought the old Clarion Hotel off of the Las Vegas Strip, which was one of the classic era hotels. Mm-hmm. And she reopened it as the Debbie Reynolds Hotel.
Oh, I never heard that.
And it had, you know, it had displays of her collection and costumes throughout. But unfortunately, she couldn't, this was after the Strip had moved over to the other Strip,
yeah,
and turned into a much flashier, different thing. In 1998, she sold the Debbie Reynolds Hotel to the WWF.
Did they get the costumes?
Their idea, no, she kept the costumes. Their idea was to tear the hotel down and build a WWF themed, they were going to build a stadium.
Oh, like an arena for their events.
Yeah, just for wrestling. And then they couldn't make a go of that, and they sold it. And in 2015, it was torn down with the idea that a new hotel was going to be built there. And it's still a vacant lot, as is so often the case.
Hollywood finally did get its memorabilia museum, though. It took the Academy to doing it, and it took decades. But
eventually,
it's not a bad museum, and they do have, like, a lot of people who do, like Spielberg now owns a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, Spielberg bought a ton of it.
And he will lend, you know, so if you want to see Rosebud Sled or a pair of ruby slippers or the gingham dress, you can see that now on A Miracle Mile.
And he started to buy that stuff when he made his money. You know, he bought Rosebud in the 80s.
Yeah.
Although there was a solid wood Rosebud used in the opening scene and then a bunch of balsa wood Rosebuds used throughout the movie. And he bought a balsa wood one.
So, oh, really? The one from the, well, I guess one of them had to burn, so that one's probably not around anymore.
Yeah, and the idea is they were all going to, you know, they were going to burn them one after another, but some of them survived. And in the final gag of all of this, in 2011, Debbie Reynolds put her collection up for auction. But at this point, there was a massive audience for it, and it was a huge like multi-million dollar deal. She ended up selling, just in the first day, she made $22, $23 million.
And this was stuff she had bought for, what did you say, $100,000 or something?
$180,000. So she sold Marilyn's subway dress for $4.6 million in 2011. The Gentlemen Wear Blondes, or Prefer Blondes dress, was $1.5 million. Judy Garland's screen test dress from Wizard of Oz was $900,000.
Not even from on camera, just from the screen test.
Yeah. And she had continued to collect memorabilia. She had Star Wars memorabilia.
That'd be pretty funny. Debbie Reynolds is like, this is the original Blade Runner car door handle.
She did. She sold the Panavision camera that they used to film Star Wars for $625,000.
Well, I guess her daughter was in it. It would be funnier if it was just random. Like, this is the hair gel from There's Something About Mary.
I mean, this was in 2011. So a lot of that stuff, you know, some of the big ticket items that have sold recently, James Bond's DB4, mm-hmm. They found the James Bond, the Lotus that was the underwater car from The Spy Who Loved Me. Yeah. They found it in a storage space. Some woman went to one of those storage space auctions. She bid $100 on a storage space in New York that had been abandoned.
This could have been anybody's underwater Lotus Esprit.
She found this thing and she was like, say what now? It's, you know, sold for ton of money. But now, as we know, Hollywood memorabilia is a massive industry. Sotheby's, Bonhams, I mean, all of the auction houses are deeply involved in it. My Facebook page is throwing up ads all the time. Tom Petty's estate, pretty much anybody that is a celebrity when they die. Was there an Alex Trebek auction?
There was an estate sale.
Yeah.
I had a friend go and she was like, do you want the signed copy of your book you signed to Alex? And I was like, no, that would be weird. Somebody else should enjoy that. But she picked up his USO jacket for me. So I have a kind of a bomber jacket that he would wear on USO tours.
That's great. See, that's perfect.
It is.
I looked at Tom Petty's auction.
Yeah, you make dumb online purchases. Have you ever bought anything?
No, I never have. But like the Tom Petty auction, I was kind of pretty intrigued by.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of stuff you wouldn't expect, like China, like porcelain dolls and like country decorations.
I remember David Lynch had golf clubs and I was like, boy, how much are these going to go for? And then it was literally like $6,000 or something for these not very good clubs.
Well, I wonder when you and I pass on whether somebody will come and buy my collection of what? What would they buy? My collection of bells?
The more famous you are, the greater the halo is, you know, because then you can be like, okay, this was a Cuisinart, but it was owned by Ben Affleck, right.
It'll be one of those things where it's like, from the estate of John Roderick, 20 pairs of Ray-Bans, and it'll sell for $15, way less than the actual value of the sunglasses.
A giant drawer of Brad's and thumbtacks? Boy.
Sorted by color.
What am I bid? And that concludes the MGM auction, entry 783.JB2813, certificate number 38661, in the omnibus. Speaking of soon-to-be valuable future memorabilia, our posts are archived, I'm sure, on various social media platforms, at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick, at Omnibus Project, even the ones where we're not anymore. We were sent emails at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Hopefully in your time, there's a giant museum of all of our stuff. Let me grab the mail. Because people would send us stuff, John.
Yeah.
For example, what do we have here? This one says, hi, Ken. Oh, nice penmanship, Kaylee. I'm sorry, is married to a fan of mine, and they sent us a wedding invitation.
Oh, how nice.
Which is still coming up in next month in San Diego. I cannot be there. Actually, this will air the week of your wedding. Congrats to Neil and Kaylee. He has listened to every Omnibus episode. He showed me the episode where you guys gave him a shortcut back when he worked at NASA. Oh, sorry, a shout-out. That makes more sense.
Yeah, shortcut and a shout-out.
We figured out a shortcut to Mars, and we shared it with our friend at NASA. We shouted out Neil. Thank you so much for the invite. I'm afraid we can't be there, but we're wishing you all the best this very week. Then Jackson sent something so lengthy and in pencil. Hello, co-host. I thought it said ex-host, but it says co-hosts of Project Omnibus. That's nice. Should we go to Project Omnibus? Should we put Project first?
Yeah.
Writing today to say that I'm a huge fan. Also, again, very nice penmanship here from... J-Tan, there we go. From Jackson. We appreciate the time we take each week. He likes it when it goes off topic for long stretches.
Yay!
So do I. I just have a very short attention span. I'm like, really? We're still talking about Kirk Kian? Actually, I am a very recently initiated fan. He has a coworker who also likes Jeopardy who recommended the show. They were sad when Alex died, but they're still watching. I appreciate that. Jackson and his coworker. Oh, and he wants us to sign a photograph of me. Sorry, I thought it was going to be of both of us.
There it is. Nope, it's just of you.
But it did say to Ken Jennings and John Roderick, he wants you to know that he wants my signature.
Yes.
And how does that make, how do you react to that?
I think it's in keeping. I mean, I think there are a lot of listeners to our show that are listening just to hear you. And they have like some kind of algorithm that just sort of not mutes me, but, you know, drops.
And then their algorithm is just in their brain. Yeah. They just stop listening. Oh, hey, Ken's talking again.
And then you're like, da-da-da-da-da.
But not this guy. Nick says, dear John, this is only to you. I don't know why I'm reading this. It's a postcard of, it's a museum and educational center at Arkansas State University, including the barn where Hemingway wrote portions of A Farewell to Arms.
Yeah, that's right.
in Arkansas? I had no idea.
Yeah, when we were reading, A Farewell to Arms in Christopher Frizzell's book club, and one of the members of the book club Zoom called us from the barn and walked the whole book club through it.
Oh, wait, this is related to that.
Oh.
He thanks you for suggesting Christopher Frizzell's book club.
Oh, there it is.
To your, I can't read it, listeners, fans, who knows, and giving me a reason to revisit Hemingway. So I guess he has joined the Hemingway Reading Society, and I can't really read the rest of this. One can only imagine that during his time, something, it's very small. Music biz? What does that say? No, something big, in-laws, hayloft. That doesn't make sense. Now using his in-laws hayloft as a retreat? Is he talking about you or Ernest Hemingway? I'm going to send you this card because maybe you will remember these Frizzlet references that I do not. Thanks for the postcard, Nick. And then wait, there was one more thing here. Ah, here it is. Brett. Oh, he's the one who sent us the Russian map of the Northwest.
Oh, yeah, that's a marvelous thing. It's right here.
Brett, we love
your map.
I have
it right there.
I don't have a map of Nike missile bases. What I do have is something that might at least equalize the balance of power. Oh, I guess because he only sent us one, then we were fighting over it. But he has now sent us, drum roll, please, the Soviet Order of Battle. What am I unfolding here? Oh.
Whoa.
It's a giant fold-out poster by the ITEC Corporation, Defense Electronics Operations, listing a lot of Soviet armaments and material along with their... it's their counts of different defense systems in different areas. For example, in Central Asia, if you're wondering how many Mi-8 helicopters the Soviets had?
Okay.
28.
That doesn't seem like that many. I would think it would be a lot more.
Well, they're keeping a lot of them for Turkestan, for example, where they have 103.
I see.
I don't know why Turkestan has so many more than Central Asia. Leningrad alone has 114 Mi-8s. This is actually right up your alley. You are going to love the... It says Soviet. It must be a misprint. But Brett offers you here the Soviet Order of Battle. Brett, thank you so much. That is awesome. I wonder how you got that. That's really great. So if you have weird stuff lying around that you don't want to sell to Debbie Reynolds, all you have to do for the cost of USPS postage, you and John and I will open it and try to figure out what it is. Any information you have on helicopters in Turkestan is welcome. If not, sympathize with other futurelings on the Facebook page or the subreddit or whatever who also wish they owned more memorabilia related to Turkestani helicopters. And of course, the best way to support Omnibus, you don't have to send us anything at all. You can, but we don't want memorabilia. We're not Debbie Reynolds. Neither of us is Debbie Reynolds. But what keeps the show running, in fact, is your support. Go to patreon.com/omnibusproject and you can see the many, many perks that come to... Oh, hey, here's your... by the way, here's your tag from when you were on the lot.
Hey, there it is. Is it just sitting there?
Yeah, it looks like you never actually put it on. It's still on the backing, which has probably led to all the trouble.
Yeah, why would I put it on? It's just... I put it in my pocket.
It says you're a visitor and you don't want that. No. You don't want people to know you're a visitor?
No, I'm sure that it's color-coded and people then who were nodding and smiling at me suspiciously would have gone, hey, that's just for teens.
This is not for visitors.
Get it out of here.
Patreon.com/omnibusproject. An array of amazing premiums and perks available to those who love the show enough to support it. Thank you in advance for everyone who did that right now. If you give now in the next 5 minutes, I will invite you to Kaylee and Neil's wedding reception in San Diego. And you don't want to miss out on that.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.